Tarek Bokhoni was born into a Palestinian Christian refugee family in Jordan. He's now a Londoner and an expert on Hamas. But all the time, as a kid, a student, an academic, he's been gay. And the collisions of all those identities is the subject of his beautiful memoir, Fire in Every Direction. Tarek has come over the road from Sydney Writers' Festival to join me in the studio. Tarek, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, look, I want to clear something up right from the start.
Okay.
You know Sydney well, don't you?
Relatively well. I haven't been here in 23 years.
Yes, but explain why you were here 23 years ago.
So I did a year abroad. I was studying for my undergrad in London, and I did my third year as a year abroad student at the University of Sydney.
And you lived, I understand from the book, in a college on the campus of the University
of Sydney. That's right, St. Andrews College.
I was going to say, you were shy of naming the college, but you name it now, St. Andrews?
St. Andrews College, yes.
Yes.
That's where I was.
Did you enjoy time in college? It must have seemed rather old-fashioned and odd.
Well, I did enjoy my time a lot. As I wrote in the book, I mean, it was a formative year for me because that's when I really grappled with my sexuality and decided to come out. And I loved being in Australia. I think it's a beautiful country. I traveled a lot throughout the country the year that I was here. And, you know, I haven't been back to Sydney since then. So 23 years have passed. And a couple of days ago, I just went walking around the university and the college. And it was nice to see how it's
changed. A couple of nights ago, did you
say? Yeah.
But it's wonderful that we can point to St. Andrews College, Sydney University, as the place that finally convinced you that you're gay, to come out,
right,
to have lovers.
You wouldn't expect that from St. Andrews, would you?
Not necessarily, no. But let me tell you, it's an old, old story.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Old stories. Your family had shifted and shifted with every phase of violence in the Middle East since the Second World War, hadn't it? Mm-hmm. Your grandmother fled Haifa in 1948?
Yeah, all four of my grandparents fled Haifa in 1948, yes.
How old was your grandmother then?
She was about 20 when she fled.
Right.
Yeah.
And they fled where?
So they fled by boat to Lebanon, so up north on the Mediterranean to Lebanon. And for a few years after the Nakba, after the dispossession in 48, the Lebanese government used to naturalize Christian refugees rather than Muslim refugees because they were playing with the demographics of the country.
So the Muslims went into the camps. Christians went into the cities.
Went into the cities. They were given citizenship, and so they were able to get flats and go to school and get educated, get jobs.
But the decision came, this time your mother's decision and your father's decision, to leave Lebanon. Why?
So in 1978, Lebanon was well on its way into a civil war. I mean, the civil war really started in 1975. And my mother at the time was very active in student politics, really, but she was engaged in the struggle for Palestine in various ways. And it was increasingly dangerous for them to stay in Lebanon as the country was in the grip of violence. And so they decided to flee to Jordan.
Why Jordan?
For several reasons, actually. I mean, I think my mother's uncle was already in Jordan when that part of the family was dispossessed from Palestine in 48. They had landed immediately in Jordan. And there was a big Palestinian community in Jordan already. Many of them had been naturalized. And so they had connections through just the Palestinian diaspora, and it felt
they
like the right
way to be. They wouldn't be arriving as absolute strangers.
No.
But you write that being a Palestinian refugee in Jordan came with some understandings. What were those understandings?
Well, a lot of the refugees in Jordan were actually not granted citizenship, unlike them, because we had arrived already as naturalized Lebanese citizens, and then we land in Jordan as citizens, not necessarily as refugees, albeit citizens of another state. The understanding was very much that you don't talk politics. You know, Jordan is a very conservative place. It's a monarchy, and there's no room for activism. There's no room for politics. And so the understanding, especially this is the understanding after Black September, when the Jordanian government had cracked down on the PLO and the Palestinian Revolution in Jordan, the understanding was that you don't touch politics.
This must have been hell for your mother.
Yes, I mean, for several reasons. The politics, on the one hand, obviously she had been an activist, in many ways a revolutionary, being told that she can't be active on Palestine anymore. But also, romantically, you know, my mother had been dating my father, and Lebanon is a very open, very progressive, at the time, quite a cosmopolitan place. And that relationship was in many ways expansive. And then she lands in Jordan and she's told by her uncle, you know, if you stay here, you're going to have to get married. You can't just be in a relationship that's not defined legally. And so she goes from being a student and an activist to being a housewife who's not active on politics in a very short period of time.
Penetrating silence seems to be one of the major reasons you wrote this book, because I get a sense that you actually knew very little about your family by the time you began investigating.
Very little.
Silence extended to being silent about the record of your own family.
Absolutely. I mean, I think growing up in Jordan and many, many people, you know, the majority of the Jordan's population are of Palestinian descent. And yet there's a lot of silence in terms of how we learn about Palestine, how we learn about our history. Even in school books, we don't get a lot of information about the history of the Palestinian struggle for all the reasons that I just mentioned. It's a very precarious situation for the Jordanian government. And so the especially Amman tends to be a very conservative, very small knit community. And so there are silences, obviously silences around politics and Palestine, but also silences around social issues. For me, the silence around queerness and being
gay.
Well,
exactly. You had a good deal to be silent about as you were growing up.
Yes. And I think in many ways, this book was, when I'm asked, I often say that I'm writing against the silence, that I'm all the things that we couldn't really talk about, I wanted to document somehow. I couldn't talk about that then, but I can talk about it now. And I wanted to have a place where I'm able to narrate what I wish could have been narrated to me in my childhood.
There's a wonderful image in the book of a set of steps that connect the classrooms in your school to the playground, with a blue railing, and you perched there on those steps, described by yourself as an ugly kid with thick glasses.
Yes.
Being mocked, ridiculed by fellow schoolboys. How did that resolve itself?
Well, it didn't. My experience of being in that school was actually one of fear. You know, I was bullied, as you say, I was ridiculed. And I always knew that I didn't quite belong in that space. I tried, as many, you know, gay boys would tell you, one of our first experiences of our sexual orientation is to try to belong, quote unquote, to be normal. Mm. So there was definitely an effort to try to be like all the other boys in the schoolyard, and that failed miserably. And so there was a lot of bullying, there was a lot of ostracization. And I guess part of it didn't resolve itself, but part of the reason I found my place was because I met a schoolboy who was in my class called Ramzi, who became a dear friend and in many ways a protector in the schoolyard. He was very popular, very sporty, you know, doing all the things that young boys were meant to do.
And he befriended you.
And he befriended me for reasons that I still can't understand.
And you worried at times that he was kind of sending you up by befriending.
Right. I didn't really trust our friendship at the beginning. I didn't quite know why he would turn to me, you know, this popular kid who's friends with all the other boys and wanted by all the other girls and sporty and wonderful, becomes a very close friend. And he's my neighbor as well. So we end up spending a disproportionate amount of time together in school and outside of school. And really, he becomes a member of my family. He's to me closer in many ways than both of my brothers.
You loved him.
And I fell in love with him.
Of course. Mm-hmm. But you knew he was straight.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew you were gay.
Well, I don't know. That's is that how it read to you in the book?
Yes, there's that letter he wrote to you saying, "Look, even if you're gay,
right,
I'll still love you."
Yes.
And when you did, the inevitable of sort of embrace him sexually or try, he still was willing to be your friend, but you were not willing to be his friend.
Right. So just
now, explain that. To me, perfectly straightforward, but to others, probably very baffling.
Right.
Explain.
Well, so this is someone that I love dearly, I fell in love with, and I, you know, wanted more than anything to be accepted by him and to be honest to him about who I am and about my feelings to him. And just just to put things in context, we would often write to each other. So this is how a lot of this communication would happen, by letters.
Because you kept the letters.
So I kept his side of the letters. I obviously don't have any of the letters I sent to him, but I have a stack of all of the letters that he sent to me over the course of a decade. And this stack is really my way into the book. So I reconstruct that childhood relationship, which is more than two decades old now, through the letters that I have from him. You know, against every reaction I get from him, I try to reimagine and reconstruct what I might have said to him. And so I reconstruct that history. And yes, so I inevitably, as you say, at some point, I tell him that I have feelings for him. And I'm imagining this boy who's much worldlier than I am, who knows, you know, the ways of life, to tell me, you know, how to deal with this challenge that I had thought myself to be facing. And, you know, I'm not going to spoil the book, but a whole series of things happen which make any kind of conversation between me and him quite difficult. And parents get involved, and it becomes a situation where I feel a great degree of shame, and I feel a huge amount of judgment, and I feel like there's just no way for us to maintain a friendship anymore, because everything's been, you know, this careful balance of trying to be friends without saying the unsayable becomes open and exposed, and there's just a lot of shame and self-loathing, I think.
How old were you at this point?
16.
Yeah. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Tarek Bakoni, who is the author of this beautiful memoir, Fire in Every Direction. Tarek, what matters most for gay men in the Middle East? Being Muslim, being Christian, being Arab?
I mean, I don't know. I don't think it's one of those things. I think that we all have very complex identities. I identify as a queer man who's also Christian, who's also Arab, and I don't hold these identities in conflict anymore. I did at some point. I thought that these were things that were irreconcilable. But I think we all have several layers of complex identities, so I think they're all in us.
But growing up and being overwhelmed as you were as a young man by shame, what's the source of that shame? Is it Christianity? Is it being Arab? Is it being sort of refugee?
No, I think every person has their particular experience. For me, I grew up quite a devout Christian. My grandmother, who was a formative figure in my life, was a Christian. My entire family are Christian, but she was very much a believer, a woman of faith, and I was raised in many ways to be a believer. And I think that was the biggest source of my shame, that actually what I was doing and who I was becoming was sinful. And so I spent a lot of my childhood years praying for forgiveness, praying for absolution. So in many ways, it wasn't necessarily being Arab, or I wouldn't have identified as an Arab. You know, I was in a relatively homogenous society. Everyone around me was the same. But I think it was what I had learned at church that was primarily the source of shame and sense of guilt.
Still a Christian?
No. I walked away from my faith around that time. When I was coming out, I realized that there were fundamental issues I couldn't reconcile with Christianity.
That's a familiar pattern.
Yes.
Yes. Tarek, what do you think of the boast of Israel that it's a particularly friendly country to gay men?
Well, I think that's a lie. I mean, I think it's a friendly country to specific gay men or specific members of the LGBTQ+ community who are Jewish. I think regardless of how Israel tries to position itself as this sort of civilized nation that's progressive, that supports queer rights, ultimately it's an apartheid regime that's carrying out a genocide. So, you know, whether you're queer or not, if you're Palestinian, you're dealing with a military occupation. And if you're in Gaza, you're dealing with genocide. Your sexuality is irrelevant. What matters is that you're Palestinian, therefore you must be killed. So this idea that Israel is, you know, a beacon for gay rights, it's just propaganda.
Another exile in your life, this time to London.
Yes.
What was it like to be in London at that time? Gay, but not facing the fact.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is actually where the whole identity of being Arab comes up. And I land in London thinking, oh, my home, everyone in Jordan, they can't accept who I am. They're backwards. I have to leave into the civilized city, London, where it's cosmopolitan, where everyone has queer rights. You know, I buy into liberalism, essentially. And it takes a minute to understand that, oh, this liberalism works only in a certain direction. If you're an Arab man in London, you're facing other forms of racism and discrimination. And all of that comes crashing to me in 2003. So this is when the Iraq war starts, and the UK, obviously, with the US, start their illegal invasion of Iraq. And suddenly I understand that for all of the ways in which I can feel like I've, you know, been accepted in this city, actually, I'm still living in a Western reality that is, that continues to be colonial, and that continues to carry out imperial invasions. And that's not really where I belong.
And is that what propelled you into the study?
Yes.
Tell us about that, sort of changing direction academically.
Yeah, so by that stage, I'm an engineer. I'm studying engineering. You know, like a good Arab boy, you have the options of going to engineering, law, or medicine, and I chose engineering, the least of all possible evils.
A good Jewish boy, yes, a good Scottish boy, a good English boy, the same choice.
You know, if you're South Asian as well, it's all of these sort of immigrant communities in many ways. But I was studying to be an engineer. And I trace, you know, a lot of people actually, and I've thought about this a lot. I don't know why for many people of my generation, 2001 was a formative experience, you know, the September 11 attacks. For me, they weren't. I for some reason, they didn't have as much of an impact on me, maybe because I was in the UK, not in the US. But for me, 2003 was very formative. And I realized that I didn't understand, you know, why was the UK invading Iraq? And what was the context around all of that? You know, I'm a young 20, 21 year old, and I'm trying to understand the politics around all of that. And that becomes then the source of some kind of obsession for me to understand Middle East politics and the history of the Palestinian people.
And so you studied essentially, I mean, what is the path to you becoming an expert on Hamas?
So I continue my studies in engineering. I graduate, I start working in engineering, but then on the side, I take some time out to finish a degree in international relations at Cambridge, and then continue into a PhD that I'm doing part-time. So I'm working full-time, I'm an engineer. I continue to work for the better part of a decade while I'm finishing the PhD part-time. And the PhD is the entry point into Hamas. So this is around 2006. Hamas is running in Palestinian elections and is winning unexpectedly. And I'm living in this world where everything in the West is sort of demonizing this movement as nothing but a terrorist organization. And Palestinians are voting for this movement. And that dissonance is my entry point into Hamas, to understand who Hamas is, what they are on their own terms, outside or beyond the narratives of the English-speaking world.
Who are they?
They're a resistance movement. I think they're a nationalist resistance movement. They are a movement who are fighting for the liberation of Palestine. And they, in many ways, they're the continuation of historic Palestinian politics of the PLO before them. The only difference is that they couch their ideology of Palestinian nationalism and resistance in an Islamic garb. So they, you know, they call for the full liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea because it's waqf, because it's a sort of an Islamic endowment that has to be held in perpetuity. The PLO before Hamas said exactly the same thing. We must liberate Palestine from the river to the sea, but that was secular nationalism. So it's a continuation of decades-old Palestinian politics, but couched in Islamist terms.
And what about their violent tactics?
I mean, all anti-colonial movements have had acts of violence, including Fatah, which is now embodied in the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. And Hamas did as well. And Hamas continues, obviously, to have engaged in violent forms of resistance, as well as popular and peaceful forms of resistance. But regardless of the nuances around its tactics, whether it's popular, peaceful, or violent, in the West, it's sort of given sort of this wide brushstroke of being a terrorist organization, which really prevents any kind of actual engagement with Hamas and deflects from the real and in many ways, multiple times more violence that Israel carries out against Palestinians.
London has an effect on many people who go there with this wonderful sense of, you know, London will be beautiful, London will be different, that's where I'll bloom, etc., etc. London has a way of teaching people that they belong where they were born.
Hmm.
But you've stayed in London.
Hmm.
How's that been?
Listen, London is an incredible city. I feel very lucky to live there. In many ways, I feel like it's home. I have a community there. I'm very established there in terms of my writing, in terms of my life. I feel grounded there. At the same time, it's not really home. It's, home is I don't know where home is. In some ways, it's in Jordan. In some ways, it's in Lebanon. In some ways, it's in Palestine. But I think this is actually an experience that many people in exile identify with, and many queer people identify with, which is that home is really the community you have and the people you love and the family that you create. Wherever that may be. And for me, that's in London at the moment.
You went back and found your grandmother's house.
I did.
But you didn't knock on the door. Now, tell me about that.
So growing up with a Jordanian passport, I wasn't allowed into Palestine because the Israeli authorities prevent the majority of Jordanian males between the ages of 18 and 45 from traveling to Palestine. And so I had to naturalize in the UK as a British citizen. And the first trip I took was to Palestine.
And that was the first time in your life?
In my life, yes.
Yeah.
And I was obviously doing field work for my PhD, but also on a personal mission of finding my grandmother's house. And I only had descriptions of how to get to the house that were communicated to me verbally. She had no map. She had no street names.
First left, second right.
First left, second right, after the hospital. And thankfully, the area that she had been dispossessed from remains relatively, obviously the Hebrew names and the street names have all changed. But the area in terms of its topography has remained relatively clear. And so I managed to find the house, incredibly. Many Palestinians, it's a very subjective experience. This is a common story for Palestinians to find their family homes and homes they have, their family members have been dispossessed from. Some people knock, some people go in, some people fight with the owners. I stood outside and I there's no way for me to know. It could be a Palestinian family living there, with Israeli citizenship. It could be an Israeli family. It could be an American Jewish family, a French Jewish family. Who knows? But I sort of felt like I actually didn't want to find out. I wanted to see the house and I wanted to imagine that the house was empty and waiting for my grandmother's return, and now she's passed, then my return one day. And I didn't want to engage in a conversation where someone would say, oh, but this isn't your house anymore, because their opinion is irrelevant. I know what's right and I know that this is our house.
Do you imagine yourself returning there one day?
I don't know. I imagine everything I work towards is to free Palestine and to get the right of return for Palestinians. So I definitely want the option of going back, because that's what justice is, to recognize that there was an act of ethnic cleansing here and that a free Palestine is the only way that we can imagine justice and peace. And I would certainly love to go back and be in Palestine and have the ability to live there, yes. But who knows? I think that's an impossible question.
But it's a pretty fundamental question, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, it's
if generations of refugee Palestinians are still wanting to return, then nothing's been resolved.
Oh, nothing's been resolved. In terms of the right of return, that's not a debatable question. For me, the right of return is for me irrefutable. I will fight to my death for the right of every Palestinian refugee to go back to their home. So that's not in question. The question is whether once that right is secured and Palestine is free, will I go back and live in my grandmother's house? I don't know. I think that will depend on whatever reconciliation process happens. But is it my right to demand that I go there? And is that my house? That's irrefutable in my mind.
Ramzi, has he read the book?
I have no idea. We haven't been in touch since...
Surely you must want to know.
you're dangerous. I have a curiosity, but I don't know if he's read the book. And I will not reach out. He's become a figment of my imagination. We haven't spoken in 25 years. I don't really know who Ramzi is today. I don't know. I have a sense of where he lives. I know that he's in a certain city and I know that he's, doing a certain job. But
yes.
Because Amman is small and everyone knows everyone. But he's a stranger to me. I know nothing about him. And
I'm laughing on this side. Yeah. I know nothing about this man.
Well,
you write so intimately and beautifully.
Well,
about.
But about, yes. about a boy that I knew 25 years ago. I don't know who he is as a man. I don't know who he is as a man he is today. I mean, he's a stranger to me today.
He's read the book.
Do you think?
Of course he has. Would you not read a book if you heard on the grapevine that somebody had written a book about you?
Yes,
as a
maybe.
Child? Of course you would.
Maybe, maybe.
Amongst the many thousands who've read your book,
well.
Tarek, and the many thousands I would recommend to read it. Thank you so much for joining us on
Late
Night Live.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I've been talking to Tarek Bokoni, author of this beautiful memoir, Fire in Every Direction. Tarek is everywhere at the Sydney Writers' Festival this weekend. You'll be hearing a lot more about and from this man. Thank you.